Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This episode contains audio and descriptions depicting violence, as well as some harsh language. Please take care when listening.
The 90s serve as a radicalizing decade for the right in the United States. Save our children! People in the United States had a lot of reason to be angry and discontented and dissatisfied.
These numbers should hit the White House like a fire alarm.
It was a decade that started off with a sharp recession.
The crisis, in short, is real.
Continuing layoffs are no surprise to workers.
For many people who lived in factory towns or industrial areas, the jobs that were going away were not coming back.
28-year service. I'm 52 years old. It's going to be hard to find something else.
It's an era of growing inequality where people are getting into more and more debt. And so there's real frustration.
This is Nicole Hemmer.
I am an associate professor of history at Vanderbilt University, and I am a scholar of conservatism, media, and the far right.
Hemmer says that in the 1990s, as middle America was in economic decline, a new and increasingly vocal group was on the rise.
Let's go get them!
What you see is the dominant political archetype of the early 1990s, the angry white male.
While it's tempting to think that the archetype of the angry white male appeared in the 2010s, white men raged underneath much of the politics of the 80s and 90s. Good-paying jobs were being farmed out to foreign countries. Policies like affirmative action, intended to level the playing field for minorities, contributed to a growing sense that American culture had turned on white men. But up through the 80s, the angry white male didn't really have a place to turn to hear views he agreed with. There were only a few major news outlets, and they tended to be politically centered or shaded to the left. But that changed in 1987, when the FCC under Ronald Reagan ended what was known as the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine, which had been around since 1949, required radio and television stations to give time and attention to opposing viewpoints on controversial issues. A TV host couldn't talk about the pro-life abortion stance without also giving equal time to the pro-choice stance, too. But with the Fairness Doctrine gone, the way was paved for stations to talk about, well, whatever the hell they wanted to. In 1988, a year after the Fairness Doctrine ended, the angry white male got his voice when a twice-divorced college dropout and relatively unknown disc jockey was given a national show.
And now here he is, Rush Limbaugh!
Thank you, Mike Tyson! And our official disclaimer here on the award-winning, thrill-packed, ever-exciting, increasingly popular, growing by leaps and bounds, Rush Limbaugh program at WABC.
The Rush Limbaugh show goes national, and it is unlike anything anyone had ever seen.
Welcome to the Rush Limbaugh program, a program exclusively designed for rich conservatives and right-minded Republicans and those who want to be either or both.
He created this very bombastic persona.
This is, of course, a bunch of balderdash, a bunch of poppycock, a bunch of gobbledygook, a bunch of BS, for those of you on the streets.
Limbaugh's unvarnished brand of performative outrage and anti-government conservatism quickly found a huge and hungry audience.
More than 7 million listeners a week hear Limbaugh lambasting liberals, railing against the homeless, beating up on feminists, gays, and those he calls peaceniks and environmental wackos.
He understood that media had to be entertaining. He used all kinds of parody songs and repeated bits. He had this thing that he would play for environmental updates. He would play Born Free and then have the rat-a-tat-tat of a machine gun and the animals crying in pain. this was really entertaining for an audience who had not had their conservatism delivered in that kind of unpredictable packaging before. He drew millions of listeners.
And like any good host, Limbaugh knew what his audience wanted to hear.
There definitely was an undercurrent of white resentment.
Several black leaders claiming that there is a double standard when blacks are on trial.
He had that kind of very flippant racism.
And I know a lot of you people are saying, boy, this Limbaugh, you're getting racist. This is not racist at all. I'm merely racist.
And Limbaugh had a core message for his angry white male listeners.
Not only are you losing out, you're losing out because the government has said that black people can have your jobs and that women can have your jobs. And oh, by the way, women aren't just coming for your jobs, but they're also coming for your position in the family. They're taking your manhood as well. It fed this sort of slate of resentments. By the early 90s, Rush Limbaugh is a powerhouse in media and pretty much synonymous with right-wing media in that moment.
As it turns out, there was a lot of money to be made in channeling the anger of the white male. Rush made millions. But over time, his show even changed the center of the GOP, as the conservative movement's most influential voices began to shift from caring about policies and politics to caring about profit. As Rush's audience grew, he became a sort of tastemaker for the Republican Party. And even though he never held elected office, he had more and more influence on Republican lawmakers.
Especially after Republicans take over the House in 1994, encouraging Republican politicians to never compromise, to never work with the liberals, to take the farthest right position that they can.
Limbaugh would continue to influence Republican politics for decades, bringing far-right ideals closer and closer to the mainstream. Limbaugh's success proved that there was a huge audience in America for right-wing thought, and every day that audience was growing. In his wake, more and more Rush Limbaughs would pop up all over the country, hoping for a share of Limbaugh's success they would range ever further to the right. They started to push the same white nationalist ideology that had long been traded in the dark corners of the right wing, passed around on self-published tracts, and handed out in pamphlets at gun shows. AM radio was full of hosts spewing that same message. The country is out of control. It's being overrun by non-whites. The government is corrupt, and America is in peril. Some of these hosts would encourage and contribute to real-world violence. Limbaugh had created a new media movement whose personalities would bring the far right into the mainstream and change the face of the American political landscape forever. I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right. Episode 4, InfoWar. If you happened to be driving across the United States in the early 90s and you had a shortwave radio, you could pick up WWCR basically anywhere. Worldwide Christian Radio.
WWCR now begins operation on 9.350.
And at a certain hour, you might hear something like this. This theme song, if you want to call it that, heralded the start of a program called The Hour of the Time, a fear-inducing cacophony of air raid sirens, women screaming, police dogs barking, and the footbeats of jackbooted government thugs. The Hour of the Time was hosted by a man named Bill Cooper, who beamed the show from his bunker of a house settled on a remote hilltop in southeast Arizona.
You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper.
Cooper was, in many ways, the original Alex Jones, a paranoid, anti-government conspiracy theorist. When the Fairness Doctrine was still in play, Cooper would have had a hard time getting any airtime at all. But it was gone and Rush Limbaugh had paved the way for Cooper to make wild claims about the state of our country.
For those of you who will do what the people in Nazi Germany did and wait and wait and wait until finally it's too late and they take you down to the railroad cars and off to a labor concentration camp, shame on you, because I'm telling you it is happening here in the United States right this very moment.
Cooper claimed that he worked in military intelligence during the Vietnam War, where he said he learned of the many conspiracies the government was trying to conceal. That it had murdered John F. Kennedy, that it was in communication with aliens, and that a shadowy cabal of elites, the Illuminati, controlled all of the governments of the world.
We have been taught lies. Reality is not at all what we perceive it to be, and a new world order is beating down the door.
He believed in the New World Order, an extension of the Illuminati theory, that the U.S. was losing its sovereignty to a shadowy global government, a cabal that included Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, and the United Nations, all conspiring together to disarm the American populace and enact their sinister plans. By 1993, Cooper was seeing signs of that coming to pass, with a standoff at Ruby Ridge.
First we had Weaver. The federal government had set him up to destroy him because he would not cooperate in spying upon his neighbors. A sniper shot Vicky Weaver in the head and killed her.
He was enraged by the Clinton administration and what had happened at Waco.
You murdered those people for nothing. They were guilty of no crimes whatsoever. You are liars. You are traitors and you are murderers. And that is the truth.
Cooper had become an influential figure with the growing far-right militia movement. And after Waco, he issued a call to arms.
Are you going to stand up on your two feet like a real man and a real woman with God by your side and take this country back and destroy these people?
Cooper wasn't the only guy advocating violence to his listeners.
And we're back here at Radio Free DC, the G. Gordon Liddy Show.
G. Gordon Liddy, a disgraced former FBI agent who had done time for his role in the Watergate scandal, had a radio talk show too, and he used his airtime to make his feelings on government agents very clear.
Oh, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms comes to disarm you, and they are bearing arms. Resist them with arms. Go for a headshot. They're going to be wearing bulletproof vests.
One listener in particular was taking the things he was hearing on right-wing radio very seriously. He was a guy who had spent some time with the Michigan militia and had seen the siege at Waco firsthand. He had been crisscrossing the country, visiting gun shows, and listening to Bill Cooper.
How many more people are you going to allow to be jailed, persecuted, burned to death, murdered, because you are a coward?
In the fall of 1994, this man and his army buddy showed up at Cooper's compound in Arizona for an unexpected visit. Cooper later said that the two were clean-cut, very polite, like military guys who were off duty. He said they were interested in his philosophical and political messages, but disagreed with him on his methods. Cooper saw violence as a last resort. These men did not. Before they left, the younger man opened the trunk of his car, which was full of copies of the Turner Diaries, and handed one of them to Cooper. "I already have a copy of that racist book," Cooper remembered telling them. As they were on their way out, they told him, "Watch Oklahoma."
As a chopper goes around the side of the federal building, wow. Look at that shot.
Holy cow.
It is absolutely incredible.
A few months after he visited Cooper's compound, Tim McVeigh blew up the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building with the help of his army buddy Terry Nichols. And when McVeigh was charged a few days later, the world turned its attention to the far-right movement and the Patriot militias that McVeigh was loosely connected to.
It was commonly said that the Oklahoma City bombing destroyed the militia movement, that even people on the extreme far right were horrified by the murder of 168 people and so on, and they kind of, you know, tucked their tails between their legs and went home. I think that's entirely false.
Mark Potok had reported on the bombing and was covering the reaction to it in the far-right militia community.
It was seen by very many people on the far right as a kind of thrilling, if a bit wild and bloody, strike back at the government. There were quite a few people saying, "Hail McVeigh."
As the dust of Oklahoma City settled, the government started looking into these militia groups. And an idea started to form on the far right that something about the bombing just wasn't right.
Propagandists and conspiracy theorists on the extreme right began to develop theories of what had really happened in Oklahoma City.
One of those conspiracy theorists was, of course, Bill Cooper.
The cremation of a human body is a two-hour process. I'm not trying to be grisly here. They claim people were vaporized by this bomb, and I'm telling you, it does not compute.
Right away, the idea came up among these people that it wasn't really McVeigh who carried out the bombing, that really it was the government that carried this out.
The militia had nothing to do with this. Patriots had nothing to do with it. And I'm telling you right now, it was the government, intelligence, community that did it. There isn't any doubt about it.
To Bill Cooper, it was just another sign that the New World Order was taking over. It would use the bombing to dismantle the militias and exert control over the populace.
The theory that developed, and is still held today by very many people, was that Bill Clinton, then the president, had orchestrated the Oklahoma City bombing with the idea that the American populace would be so horrified by the bloody carnage that it caused that we, the people, would be willing to accept draconian anti-terrorism legislation and, presumably, the seizure of our weapons, the long-feared national gun seizure.
It didn't help matters that not long after the bombing, President Clinton did propose anti-terrorism legislation.
America will never surrender to terror. America will never tolerate terrorism.
And that only added fuel to the conspiracy fire.
And he tells you about the counterterrorism piece of legislation, which outlines exactly how he's going to strip all of our liberties from us.
That idea took hold in a very big way. At the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, there were 224 anti-government militias.
By the next year, there were 858 such groups. And that was when Bill Clinton signed his anti-terrorism bill into law.
President Clinton, in fact, authorized the hiring of 500 new FBI agents with the specific task of looking at the extreme right and threats from the extreme right.
America will never abide terrorists. Wherever they come from, wherever they go, we will go after them.
As the investigation into Oklahoma City continued, President Clinton recognized that right-wing talk radio had played a role in the bombing.
We hear so many loud and angry voices in America today. They spread hate. They leave the impression that violence is acceptable. You ought to see, I'm sure you are now seeing the reports of some things that are regularly said over the airwaves in America today.
It came to light that Timothy McVeigh listened to Bill Cooper all the time. In a White House memo, Clinton reportedly called Bill Cooper the most dangerous radio host in the country.
People like that who want to share our freedoms must know that their bitter words can have consequences.
Cooper was no stranger to paranoia and must have been feeling the heat. On his show, he warned his militia listeners.
If they make any move against the legal and lawfully constituted militias of the several states under any pretext, you must resist by any means available to you, including some that you haven't even thought of yet. If they want to start it, we are surely capable of finishing it.
What happened was in 96, 97, 98, the government uncovered a whole series of plots involving violence from groups and individuals on the radical right.
Federal agents arrested seven members of the so-called West Virginia Mountaineer Militia in connection with what officials alleged to have been a plot to blow up an FBI information center.
You know, every few weeks, there would be another remarkable story in your local newspapers about some plot.
A familiar story these days, another militia group busted.
Police say this particular militia cell was planning to commit acts of terrorism throughout Southern California.
The LAPD Anti-Terrorism Division had been watching the group since the Oklahoma City bombing.
If you look back to the 1980s, when certainly there was some violence from radical right-wing groups, by and large, law enforcement was rather reluctant to take them on. After Oklahoma City, that was no longer true.
All across the country, the government was foiling plot after plot, and out in the West, getting into standoff after standoff with regional militias.
In West Texas tonight, an old-fashioned manhunt for the two remaining members of the separatist group, the Republic of Texas.
In the Big Sky country of Montana, federal agents today arrested the leaders of an armed group that denies the legitimacy of the U.S. government.
An awful lot of people were being put in prison, and there were only so many people who were willing to go to prison to defend these ideas, especially if it meant, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 years in prison. The movement was in part suppressed by serious work on the part of law enforcement.
By June of 2001, a number of far-right militias in the United States had disbanded or gone underground after increased pressure from the government. But an increasingly bitter and paranoid Bill Cooper was still on the radio, ranting about the Oklahoma City bombing conspiracy.
Now, how stupid can you be to believe that Timothy McVeigh was the mastermind of the destruction of the Alfred P. Muir Federal Building in Oklahoma City?
Cooper's shows were becoming increasingly incoherent. He rarely left his hilltop bunker of a home in Arizona and had long ago stopped paying his taxes. And he believed the government was after him, which was actually true. The FBI considered him to be armed and dangerous and was weighing a raid on his home. But on this day, amid all the talk of conspiracy, Cooper was about to declare something really prescient. CNN had recently aired an interview with one of the U.S. government's biggest terror targets abroad, Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden, a Saudi hiding out in Afghanistan, had declared a holy war against the United States. His group, Al-Qaeda, had orchestrated two U.S. embassy bombings in East Africa that left more than 200 people dead, and had attacked the USS Cole, a Navy destroyer, in Yemen, killing 17 sailors.
Now we're being bombarded with messages that Osama bin Laden is planning to attack the United States of America. And I'm telling you, be prepared for a major attack. But it won't be Osama bin Laden. It will be those behind the New World Order who once again want to take the guns and the freedom away from the American people because we're the only ones left.
A few months later, Cooper's prediction came true.
This just in, you are looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. CNN Center right now.
On September 11th, 2001, an audibly shaken Bill Cooper took to the air while the towers burned.
What we're witnessing now today is most probably the herald of the, at least, the redefinition of freedom, and most probably its death.
There was a feeling that day that more attacks could be possible and could come from anywhere. No one yet knew why this had happened or what would happen next. But the 9/11 attacks jerked the attention of the government sharply, away from domestic terror and toward international terror. For the next decade, the government would not be at war with its own people. On the hour of the time that day, Cooper stopped short of accusing the government of the attack. But he laid out early seeds of what would later become the 9/11 Truther movement.
And I have no idea who carried this out. But I know exactly why. They need excuses to continue to pass laws to strip people of their rights and of their freedoms and to disarm people.
The hour of the time was never a good place to get the truth. But that day, Cooper seemed more disposed than usual to stick to the facts.
Don't report rumors. Don't report anything that comes over your fax machine. Don't report anything that you hear from Alex Jones or any of his ilk.
By this time, Alex Jones had launched InfoWars and had grown to national recognition, in part for rebuilding the Branch Davidian Church at Waco. He was starting to dabble with his newfound power, seeing how far he could stretch the truth.
It's absolutely out of control. It is pandemic, ladies and gentlemen. I'll give you the news first on Y2K.
On New Year's Eve, 1999, he caused a panic among his thousands of listeners when he reported that Y2K was causing nuclear plants to malfunction across the country.
A power plant has been blown up.
In Oregon.
Okay, we need to get CNN on. I'm sure at the studios at GCN, they're checking that out. But I firmly side on the fact that we need to go ahead and just report the truth. It creates a panic, it does.
The President of the United States had once called Bill Cooper the most dangerous radio host in America. So it was notable that Cooper himself was shocked by Alex Jones's brand of carelessness.
It is deception. It's fear-mongering. It scared the hell out of literally millions, a lot of people, headed literally for the hills just from listening to these guys. If these guys had succeeded in whipping up a hysteria that would have caused a large segment of the population to panic and riot in the streets, I got to tell you, folks, there's times when law enforcement and government agencies and things like that are needed.
That's right. Bill Cooper, the anti-government poster boy, felt that the government needed to step in and do something about Alex Jones. Jones had taken Bill Cooper's shtick to a different level, and a feud started between the hosts. Over time, Cooper's surprise at his reckless protege turned into anger.
I will chew you up. I will spit you out for the lying, stinking, rotten little coward that you are. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all I have to say about Mr. Sensationalist, lying, rumor-mongering, bullshit artist, Alex Jones.
A lot could be said about Bill Cooper's relationship to the truth. He lived in a different world, but he was appalled by liars because he did not consider himself to be one. Ultimately, one of the things he often said would become a self-fulfilling prophecy, that the government would try to eliminate patriots like him. By late 2001, Cooper was reclusive and paranoid. He stayed in his home on the hilltop in Eager, Arizona, and was known to brandish guns and chase off people he felt were trespassing. After one incident where he followed a family home and pointed his pistol at them, the state of Arizona charged him with felony aggravated assault. The local sheriff was trying to figure out how to arrest him without bloodshed. On November 5th, 2001, a group of drunk teenagers showed up near Cooper's house, playing loud music. When Cooper came out to investigate, he realized that they weren't drunk teenagers at all, but plainclothes deputies who ordered him to freeze. As Cooper retreated to his house, he turned and fired, shooting one of the deputies in the head. He was shot 9 times and died in a hail of gunfire. In the end, Cooper would not get to see much of the post-9/11 world. His death marked the end of an era for the far-right movement, where things were changing fast.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack.
A Republican president was in office, one who had little interest in gun control, much less seizing the guns of private citizens. His government was now solely interested in one threat, those who carried out 9/11.
The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts. I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice.
In the wake of the attacks on 9/11, America would wage war in Afghanistan and Iraq.
This is what it looked and sounded like in Baghdad, the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
The militia movement's long-standing war with the federal government was put aside, as many members enlisted to fight the bigger threat abroad. All across the country, men and women were joining up.
The September 11th attacks led to a surge of patriotism. Nearly 76,000 men and women joined the active duty army.
In Iraq, what was supposed to be a quick and heroic mission to depose Saddam Hussein quickly turned into a quagmire. Americans watched it live 24 hours a day on the new number one news network.
Live from the world headquarters of Fox News in New York. Fair news, balanced news.
Fox News starts in 1996. It's after the September 11th attacks that it really becomes the powerhouse that it would end up being.
Nicole Hemmer again.
And it's in that moment that it gets its patriotic zeal. All of the red, white, and blue, and the stars and stripes, and the big flashy headlines, and the constant breaking news alerts.
Vice President Dick Cheney said the U.S. has the military might to score a decisive victory. He predicted that the Iraqi people will welcome a U.S. invasion force as...
Fox News provided something other networks like CNN didn't. A positive, patriotic spin on an unpopular war that had nothing to do with 9/11.
This is a picture of Saddam Hussein's statue. U.S. forces may be about to blow up this statue. In the next few minutes, well, it looks like it just got blown up, ladies and gentlemen. Oh my gosh.
Fox News told its viewers what they wanted to hear, that the war in Iraq was justified and that we were winning.
Fox News, especially in its early days, was trying to both be this we report, you decide outlet, but also was full of commentators.
We come back. Fox News under fire for being too patriotic. Wow.
There's this idea at Fox News that there were two separate parts of the channel. There was the news side and there was opinion side, and never the two shall meet. But of course, they blended all of the time. Commentators would come on air during news segments, would read news segments.
People like Bill O'Reilly would deliver headlines right before giving opinions like this one.
According to all the military experts, the war is going well. Saddam's days are indeed numbered. But if you watch...
Most Americans don't read a news channel like they do a newspaper. They don't see the difference between the reporting and the op-ed page.
Fox News commentators took a page out of Rush Limbaugh's book. With the fairness doctrine gone, they could say what they wanted without having to present the other side. But theirs was an innovation Limbaugh could only dream of. They could present right-wing opinion while still calling it news.
Finally, Talking Points freely admits rooting for America, Britain, and Australia in the war against Iraq.
Fox News was the brainchild of conservative media tycoon Rupert Murdoch, who saw an opportunity to harness the anger that pulsed through America's radio airwaves in the 1990s and put it on television. Murdoch was the money, but the brains was a longtime Republican media consultant and veteran of the Nixon, Reagan, and Bush campaigns named Roger Ailes.
Roger Ailes was a full-on culture warrior who believed that liberals were destroying what was truly good and unique about the United States and that liberals themselves needed to be snuffed out. Fox News was about drowning out those liberal voices, advancing a different vision, and ultimately, for both men, winning elections for Republicans.
Even amid controversy over America's foreign wars, Fox News did help to deliver George W. Bush a second term. But by 2007, approval for the war in Iraq had shifted dramatically. According to a Pew Research poll, two-thirds of the country no longer felt the war was going well. An election was on the horizon, and America was ready for change.
I will promise you this, that if we have not gotten our troops out by the time I am president, it is the first thing I will do. I will get our troops home. We will bring an end to this war. You can take that to the bank.
A young, charismatic black senator from Illinois, Barack Obama's campaign swept the country in a wave of optimism that things could change for the better.
Generations of Americans have responded with a simple creed. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
It turned out to be the change that much of the country was looking for. Obama won the presidency in a landslide.
Americans sent a message to the world that we have never been just a collection of individuals or a collection of red states.
and blue states. We are and always will be the United States of America.
By the time that Barack Obama becomes president, there is a robust conservative media ecosystem that is champing at the bit, that's ready for blood.
Even at the inauguration of a black president, it seems white America is being called racist.
Fox News had a new wave of commentators, including Glenn Beck, who mixed the conspiratorial mind of Alex Jones and Bill Cooper with the bombastic style of Rush Limbaugh.
The Manchurian candidate couldn't destroy us faster than Barack Obama.
Obama had promised universal health care for all. Beck's response wasn't exactly measured.
We all gonna be living under a bridge soon, fending off bums with a beer bottle.
To hear Beck and the other commentators tell it, Obama was some kind of socialist, communist tyrant.
It's almost like we're living in Mao's China right now.
This is Joseph Stalin without the bloodshed.
This is what Hitler did.
You have to remember that at this point, Fox News was hugely influential, and their viewers took them seriously.
Obama kind of scares me. I think we might be headed towards a socialist nation. We could very well be a welfare state.
Meanwhile, the Republican Party was still reeling from the major election upset.
You have a Republican Party that is largely bereft of leadership. They, in fact, take a poll in 2009 to ask who the leader of the Republican Party is. And the person who comes in first is no one. And the person who comes in second is Rush Limbaugh.
And we are back. Rush Limbaugh on the cutting edge of societal evolution.
He was the voice of the right. And he was going to use that voice to pretty vociferously attack Barack Obama.
Not only do I want Obama to fail, I want once and for all the American people to see full frontal nudity on what liberalism is and what a lie it is.
Limbaugh and the rest of the right-wing media ecosystem attacked Obama the one way they knew how, by spreading conspiracy theories, like the one that he was secretly Muslim. After all, his middle name was Hussein.
Imam Hussein Obama.
Barack Hussein Obama, father Muslim, grandfather Muslim.
Obama's Muslim nation.
That false claim stuck with viewers and listeners, too.
Nearly 20% of Americans think President Barack Obama is a Muslim.
Right-wing media fueled a conspiracy theory that Obama was actually born in Kenya, a claim that would lead a well-known New York real estate tycoon to call for the president to release his birth certificate.
You know, this guy either has a birth certificate or he doesn't.
Donald Trump.
If you weren't born in this country, you cannot be president.
But do you think he was born in this country?
I am really concerned.
And then they turned to the classics, that Obama was part of a shadowy government cabal. The New World Order.
While his New World Order tour traveled across Europe,
we are heading toward a one world sort of government.
The shadow government behind the scenes.
And that all-time classic, a throwback all the way to the Turner Diaries.
Barack Obama says he didn't want to take away your guns.
No.
But his actions tell a very different story.
Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh said, he's coming for your guns. He's coming for your ammunition.
Your Second Amendment gun rights are under fire.
In Ohio, citizen soldiers train for urban combat, while snipers in Michigan practice with high-powered weapons.
With all the throwback conspiracy theories resurging in the media, maybe it wasn't a surprise that the militia movement was coming back, too.
A report out today claims 50 new militia training groups have sprung up in less than 2 years. And the right-wing extremists, historically motivated by a distrust of government, are now especially angry about the election of America's first African-American president.
What we see is, quite predictably, a reactionary backlash about the election of the first black president.
Kathleen Ballou is a historian studying the rise of the far-right movement.
People in the movement were very likely swayed by things like the sort of conspiracy theories about birtherism. We know that gun purchases went through the roof. And we began to see the aftermath effects of the global war on terror.
The U.S. had started to bring troops home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And like Tim McVeigh had been after the Gulf War, some of those returning veterans were traumatized by what they had experienced and disillusioned with the government.
Across American history, surges in right-wing extremism have aligned more closely with the aftermath of warfare than they have with populism, immigration, poverty. The big thing is the aftermath of warfare.
Veterans coming home were prime targets for far-right militia recruitment.
Veterans are useful to these groups because they bring weapons expertise, munitions training, tactical training that they can use to escalate violence among white power activists.
In 2009, the Department of Homeland Security issued a report to notify law enforcement agencies about the potential for more far-right threats.
The Fox News sphere of commentators blew up.
Well, a new government report singling out military veterans as a potential threat. My next guest calls the report an insult.
The idea was sort of, how could any person who had ever served in uniform possibly become a threat to the country?
It should never focus out veterans. You look at the men and women coming back, incredible, the best of our generation.
Oh, the best, absolutely.
It didn't take right-wing media long to spin the report as an attack on all conservatives.
Without being too conspiratorial, I'm wondering if all this isn't just a desire on the part of the administration to shut up its critics.
Apparently also, if you like guns, they should pull you over because you're apt to right-wing extremism.
They sort of said anyone who owns a gun, they're coming for you and they're going to say you're a terrorist, which is definitely not what this report said.
It's slanderous, it's insane, it's insulting, it's all those things. And worse yet, if we paid for this. Anyway.
Eventually, the political backlash was so bad that Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano had to make a public apology. The report was buried, and the unit that created it, one charged with watching domestic extremism, was shut down. The ultimate consequence was that for the next 7 years, no one at DHS would be watching the far right. And the irony is that while all of this was happening, a new militia group formed that would become incredibly consequential in the far-right movement. Just days after that DHS report was leaked, a veteran named Stuart Rhodes, founder of a brand new militia group called the Oath Keepers, gathered a group of veterans on the green where the Battle of Lexington was fought.
You can be on my team any day. I love you and honor you and thank you for your service.
Rhodes was there to do exactly what the DHS report had warned of, recruit military and law enforcement veterans, people who, as the group's name implies, swore an oath to protect the Constitution.
We will not obey orders to disarm the American people.
The Department of Homeland Security had been right to be concerned. In 12 short years, Stuart Rhodes would be among those leading the assault on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. On the next episode of Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right, a revitalized militia movement stages a standoff on the Western frontier. A standoff that the federal government loses.
The West has now been won!
If you want to learn more about the conservative revolutionaries who remade American politics in the 1990s, check out Nicole Hemmer's book, Partisans. She also hosts an excellent podcast called Past Present, if you're interested in more history. Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right is a co-production of Longlead and Campside Media. The show is produced by Ryan Swikert. Callie Hitchcock is our associate producer. Executive producers are John Patrick Pullen and Josh Dean, who also served as Long Shadow story editors. Audience development by Heather Muse. Will DeGravio is our research assistant. Fact-checking by Rebecca Holland. Claire Mullen did the mix. Sound design by Ryan Swikert. Music by Blue Dot Sessions and APM. Cover art by Longlead's creative director, Sarah Rogers. A special thanks to Jennifer Bassett, who consulted on the podcast. Learn more about Longlead and subscribe to our newsletter at longlead.com. If you're enjoying the show, spread the word and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find the show. I'm Garrett Graff, and thanks for listening.